welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. We are committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today I'm going to do exactly that. I have a guest who's written a very, very interesting book titled On Gender and the Soul, subtitled An Exploration of Sex, Gender, and Its Relation to the Soul According to the Church Fathers. And I think this is transcendently interesting in that you would think that this is a 21st century issue, but it's actually an issue that the fathers, the early church, apostolic fathers, fathers, apologists, the early church authorities dealt with back in the early centuries of the church. So this is not a new issue to Orthodox Christianity. This is an issue that we have been dealing with for a long period of time, and therefore there's a historical precedent for how to deal with this issue in a way that helps rather than hurts. As prologue to this podcast, I want to tell a story. It actually comes from Douglas Murray. That's where I first heard it. He's the author of The Madness of Crowds, and I did a podcast with him some time ago. And he talks about how numerous testimonies of people who enter into the process of sex reassignment later regret it. And so he tells the story of a woman named Nancy, later became a man named Nathan. And he says that Nathan was born a girl and at some point decided that she would be better off as a he. So she began partaking in hormone therapy, then a double mastectomy, and then a series of surgeries to construct a penis. Three surgeries later, Nathan, formerly Nancy, was poised to celebrate her rebirth as a man. And here's a quote from Nathan, again, formerly Nancy. Quote, when I looked in the mirror, I was disgusted. My new breasts did not match my expectations, and my new penis showed symptoms of rejection. And then there was the scarring, both physically and metaphysically. Deep depression overwhelmed me. So what happened? After the expenditure of a great deal of money on doctors and drugs and hospital procedures, this woman was euthanized due to unbearable suffering. And that was only a year after the last sex change procedure. And her very last words prior to lethal injection were these, I do not want to be a monster. So a health service provider tried to turn a girl into a boy, a woman into a man. They failed, and then they killed her. The takeaway is simply this. The trans train has roared into our lives far faster than the LGB trains of the past. And what Time magazine breathlessly touted as the next civil rights frontier plowed over yet another life. And this is what we're talking about on the podcast today. Make no mistake, we're not supposed to be talking about this. To question whether a surgically constructed penis or a double mastectomy can turn a girl into a boy is a tripwire you stumble over at your own peril. But this is an issue that we have to talk about. And this is an issue that, as I began this podcast saying, has been ably dealt with in a very important book. Again, the book is titled On Gender and the Soul. The author is Benjamin Cabe. He graduated summa cum laude from St. Tikhon's Orthodox Theological Seminary. He founded Conciliar Post, which is a website. And he also founded Theoria, a YouTube channel. But for today's podcast, we're focusing on his book, again, On Gender and the Soul. This book available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. You can check it out on the web at equip.org. With that, by way of introduction, welcome to the podcast, Benjamin.
Thanks, Hank.
I am so glad to have you here to talk about this extraordinarily important subject. And I want to start off with a simple question. I mean, what is sex and what is gender?
Yeah, it's interesting because it should be a simple question. But if you go anywhere on a college campus or you go out in the public and ask this question, people will be hard-pressed to give you an answer. The linguistic signifier sex and gender functionally meant the same thing until the 1960s, when a psychiatrist from Johns Hopkins, John Money, started using sex to identify the biological reality and gender to speak about social constructs. Now, this initial bifurcation doesn't necessarily pose too much of an issue for us as Orthodox, because a lot of gender roles are arbitrary. So, for instance, men don't cry. We've heard this before. It doesn't mean that if a man cries, maybe he's emotionally more like a woman. Maybe he really is a woman. No, it just means that the stereotype is that men like sports, men don't cry, women are more emotional. But something else happened in academia with the rise of Judith Butler. Judith Butler in the 90s wrote a book called Gender Trouble. And she started criticizing the stereotypes and essentially said male and female anatomy was solidified over time by the cultural reenactment of these stereotypes. And so for her, gender was performative. Essentially, you know, if you're a biological man and you want to wear dresses and you want to be a homemaker, no problem. Just start performing that role. She didn't place importance on cosmetic modification. That happened a little later. And this is where there's a split in gender theory from what I like to call academic gender theory, which we've been talking about up till now, and pop gender theory. Pop gender theory is what trickled down to the masses, and gender again was reassigned from the social sphere to the internal part of man. So that if you feel like a woman, then that means you are a woman. This, of course, is embodied perfectly by Bruce Jenner, who came out in 2015, saying to, I believe it was Diane Sawyer, that in my soul, I feel like a woman and I truly am a woman. He went on to have the cosmetic modifications, the surgery, and now lives as Caitlyn Jenner. So in the cultural vernacular right now, sex, or what they would call sex assigned at birth, is the biological. And gender is what is internal, the way you feel, how you see yourself, and so on.
And you've chosen to use the word sex and gender interchangeably.
Yes.
And why is that significant? I mean, as an Orthodox Christian or a Christian of any stripe, why is it important for us to use those terms interchangeably?
Well, I think this is demonstrated in the book, and this is essentially the whole goal of the project, is that it's theologically, anthropologically untenable for us as Orthodox Christians to make a division between bodily sex and internal perceived gender. It anthropologically does not hold. And so for me, using these terms interchangeably is a way to say that a man is a man and a woman is a woman.
Yeah, and so this whole notion of decoupling sex and gender is the root of all kinds of problems in the modern world.
Oh, yeah. So what wound up happening over the course of time is that not only do you have a strict binary of people saying, you know, I feel like a woman, but I'm a biological man, therefore, you know, I'm going to make this surgery, but also that gender now can be whatever you want it to be. And however many people there are in the world, essentially, each person could be a complete island and a totally different gender, you know, depending on how they feel. You can make it up. The last I saw, there were 256 official genders. It probably has grown since then. And I'm not sure how you get on the list. But the problem is, too, it is so confusing because it's changing so rapidly.
Yeah, absolutely. We've spent some time defining terms, but this is really important in your writing, in your speaking. You always get back to the central issue of defining terms, because words are not, as I typically say, not univocal, they're equivocal. It depends on the meaning that you're pouring into those words. So to have a fruitful discussion, you really have to define your terms.
Yeah.
This is a lightning rod issue. And therefore, it's not only being clear about terminology, but it's also speaking about this issue with love and respect. We're trying to heal, not hurt. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so our goal in Orthodox theology is always the healing of the human person. And when we're speaking about these issues, especially with writing a book like this, it was my desire to be very clear that this is not something to use as a kind of hammer over the heads of people. I did not want this to be artillery in a cultural war. This is addressing an issue that people are legitimately struggling with. In the case of those struggling with gender dysphoria, it's an extremely painful condition. And our goal is not to just, you know, tell them that they're wrong and move on. Our goal is to see that person and that pain healed through Christ.
Yeah, I totally get that. And yet there's a sense in which you want to scream, watch out, because you think about the story of Nancy who becomes Nathan and ends up being euthanized. I mean, it's a story that's not a singular event, but there are so many people who are disfiguring their bodies because of a false concept, because of a mad rush to decouple gender from sex.
Yeah.
So let's talk about something that is at the root of this issue. And this is what your book is primarily about. Whether or not the soul or the non-corporeal aspect of humanity can be sexed. Is the soul sexed? What do the church fathers say about this issue?
So this is hitting the point, asking the question that the society at large is asking, is it possible for an internal reality, whatever you call that reality, whether you call it the soul or so on, is it possible for that to be a different sex or gender than the biological body? What's interesting is the church fathers are pretty strident on this point, and it's not that they were dealing with the same kind of transgender ideology that we're dealing with today. But they were making these claims to support essentially the theology of the church from the heretics at the time. And whether it's St. Athenagoras or St. Jerome or St. Augustine or St. Cyril of Alexandria, St. Gregory the theologian, they're all unified in saying that the soul itself is sexless.
So this is the position of the historic Christian faith. The soul has no sex.
Yes.
But we're body-soul unities, and therefore, as body-soul unities, we have sex, even though the soul is sexless.
Yes. The human person made up as body and soul together, not one without the other. Sex is important because the body is important. And when we look at it through the vantage point of Orthodox Christian theology and the resurrection of the body, we can understand that by grace, we've been given eternal life. We've been given, you know, this after we die, we are still sentient. We're still conscious. We're still aware. And with respect to the resurrection of the body, St. Jerome would say all of the parts and members are indeed resurrected. And so the human being as a body-soul unity always has a definite sex, even if the soul itself, as incorporeal, is sexless.
So there is a time, though, let's say my mother or father, they both have passed on. They're absent from the body. They're present with the Lord. My mother, obviously female. My father, obviously male.
Yes.
Even though they're disembodied, they're still male and female because there's a continuity that takes place, right?
Yes.
And that continuity precedes the time of death, and it will continue on after the second coming of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. At that point, we're not going to be androgynous. We're going to have the same sex that we had while we lived on this planet, and that will continue on for all eternity.
Yes, yes. And this is an interesting point, because that unnatural parting of body and soul at the time of physical death is actually something that St. Augustine talks about. He talks about having what he calls a quasi-corpus, or a semblance of a body, and it's due to that deep relationship and that continuity that, let's say, for instance, in stories of saints appearing to people, they appear as male or female, depending on, you know, whether it's a nun, or like Saint Seraphim appears as Saint Seraphim, not some androgynous form.
How important is Orthodox anthropology in addressing a question like this?
Well, I think it's absolutely crucial. It's crucial in the sense that the Church has given us a great resource over the last 2,000 years to draw upon. And while the soul itself and our understanding of the soul, even in the Old Testament, is in a nascent form, and we see it gradually expand into the New Testament, and then the Church Fathers again are articulating based off of the New Testament and the revelation of our Lord and the advent of his ministry, are talking about it. And the healing of the human person is all anthropology in a sense, because the healing of the aspects of the soul, you know, those parts when we feel angry or upset, which can be transformed into zeal for God, or our mind, which may constantly be thinking of wrongs that people have done to us, can be transformed into remembrance of God, and our desire, likewise, from desire for something like sweets or donuts or sex, into desire for God.
How do incorrect beliefs about the nature of the soul lead to incorrect views with respect to our salvation? This even accompanies how we would view the salvation of women.
Oh, yeah. Yes. So this is a really interesting point. The human being is a microcosm, as we've said, body and soul together, not one without the other. And by having body and soul together, he participates in the immaterial and the material. And so the immaterial creation, the incorporeal, we would understand as the angels, the angelic creation. And the cosmos, of course, is materiality. Materiality is interesting because you can have division of parts without having division of essence. We all are male and female, though we have different organs, different chromosomes, we participate in the same materiality. What's interesting, though, is the immaterial. You see this in theology of angels. You see this in the early heresy of Eunomianism, which talked about the energies of God being outside of God himself. The Church Fathers, when they respond to these, are very strident that any division of an incorporeal reality would be a division of energy, and a division of energy necessarily is a division of essence.
I want to isolate a quote from your book and have you comment on it. You write, "If the souls of men and women differ by essence, then Christ assumed only a male nature and a male soul along with that male nature. This means that the souls of women are not and cannot be saved." What do you mean by that?
Yes, so we all have one human nature, man and woman alike. This is a tenet of the Church. And being that the materiality is divisible without being divisible by essence, we as men and women participate in the same materiality, and we participate in the same reality of the soul. And these two together, these two different essences, immaterial and one material, form the composite, which is human nature. Now, if souls are substantially different from men and women, meaning there's something in the man's soul that is not in the woman's soul, or the soul itself is something in one of these and not in the other, this would be considered, because the parts of the soul are understood as energies. If there's a difference of energies, we know from Paul Amos, we know this from the Cappadocian Fathers, if there's a substantial difference between energies, like so that one energy is something that the other energy cannot be or is not, then it divides that immaterial reality by essence. And so instead of having one human nature, if souls are sexually differentiated, you would have one male nature and one female nature. And that which is not assumed is not healed is the famous phrase from St. Gregory the Theologian. And so whereas we understand that Christ assumed all of it, what it means to be a human being, but came in a male form. If there is a difference between male and female souls, then he only redeemed the male soul.
So this has a pretty significant impact in terms of the discussion overall on all of humanity.
Yes.
And most principally the women that you're talking about. When does the soul enter the body?
Yeah, so this is a great question. The church fathers are pretty strident at conception. Like, there are a couple of different ways we can talk about this. There's traducianism and creationism, as far as like, where does the soul come from? At what point does it sort of get melded with the body? But the general consensus, from what I'm aware, is at conception, there's a creation of a new human being, which necessarily includes body and soul together.
Yeah, and I think this is really important. I mean, when a woman conceives, she does not conceive merely a body. She conceives a body-soul unity. And
yes,
what is conceived at that point is either male or female. You mentioned theosis a lot in your book. This whole sex-gender issue is inextricably woven together with theosis. Vladimir Lossky said that the history of salvation can be likened to the history of a shipwreck. If you're shipwrecked and you're saved in a shipwreck, you go to the port of salvation. But the port of salvation is not the goal. The goal is for the saved to continue on a journey whose sole goal is union with God. So the issue of theosis is inextricably connected to this whole notion of being body-soul unity, of being male or female, of this binary notion that we hold to in Orthodox Christianity. And so this is critical, not just from the standpoint of what can happen to a person when their body is mutilated, but this has an ongoing impact for all eternity because we're on a continuum that never ends.
Yeah, so men and women, speaking of vocation, I mean, at the very base of it, we have that command of our Lord to be fruitful and multiply. And when we are living out our Christian lives, we have embodied reality. This is not a disembodied reality like we just maybe say a few prayers in our heads. This is the man or the woman, the human being, working out his salvation with fear and trembling in body and soul alike. It's not a psychological thing. It's an integrated thing. So the idea of, and I want to be clear on this, you know, just because we're making a rhetorical distinction between the body and the soul does not mean we're falling into dualism or anything like that. That which is done to the body does affect the soul. Now, this is mysterious, and I would be remiss if I claimed to be able to describe exactly how or what that is. But bodily mutilation is one of these things that, as we saw with the story of Nancy, who became Nathan, winds up leading to the last straw of despair. And a lot of these sex change operations that we see is kind of, it's an effort to release the person from pain. And when the effort proves that the pain is still there, in many cases, it's too much. It's too much because that was all of their hope.
You write about a lot of different things in your book, but one of the issues that caught my attention is the materiality of the soul. And that's with respect to contrast being the conduit to clarity, meaning that in comparison to God,
yeah,
the soul would be said in some sense to be material because only God is truly immaterial. Can you cash that out a little bit for us?
Yeah, sure. So St. John of Damascus in his book on the Orthodox faith talks about the immaterial of God. And when he talks about the creation of the angels and then later the soul of man, he talks about them as immaterial compared to the materiality of the cosmos, but not truly immaterial because it had a beginning. God himself, the only one without beginning, is the only one that is truly immaterial. And so the soul, when compared to that, could be described as having a denseness, I believe is the way St. John of Damascus puts it. It's mainly a thing with beginninglessness in God.
Yeah, so essentially in common vernacular, when we talk about the soul, we're talking about the immaterial aspect of humanity. When we talk about the body, we're talking about the material aspect of our humanity.
Exactly.
Kind of interesting too, just a side note here, maybe you can comment on whether Christ's resurrection body was different than his pre-resurrection body. It seems to me that as we become more and more godlike, that even the nature of our body changes in some sense. It's the same physically, but it's different organizationally in some sense.
Yeah, so the church fathers talk a lot about the freedom from necessity in a sense. And so the resurrected body will be free from the necessity to eat or drink. And we notice in scripture that Christ appears in rooms, or maybe he's not recognized at first. And then he says something and the apostles' eyes are opened and they recognize him. And so the common way that the patristic literature talks about this is kind of along the lines of what St. John of Damascus said. It talks about the lightness of the spirit. And so we have saints, for instance, that have essentially floated up when they pray. This is the same thing that is happening. Like, we're becoming by grace what God is by nature. And so what we understand as the normal bounds of reality are really the normal bounds of fallen reality. And so our journey towards Christ and towards this theosis, we can live out and experience aspects of that and results of that in the present.
Another thing that you point out in the book, which I think needs to be elaborated on, is that medical science stands today in the 21st century, as it always has, on the side of the Holy Fathers of the Church.
Yeah. So it's interesting because whether you get a sex change operation or not, whether you are a biological man and feel like a woman, if you die today under, let's just say, of natural causes, and someone digs you up in 100 years or 1,000 years and they run tests, it's going to show your biological sex. And there's even a discussion in the early church considering bodily mutilation about castration. And this was something that was struggled with for a long time. And eventually the line was, you know, don't voluntarily do this. If this happened to you, then just live out your life, but essentially don't castrate yourself. But St. Augustine, for his part, even said the eunuch, everyone says the eunuch is still male.
Because biological sex is stamped on every cell of the body, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
How does evolutionary anthropology stand in opposition to orthodox anthropology? So in evolutionary anthropology, you have a denial of the reality of the soul. The physical facts fix all the facts. Everything's just material. So there's a big difference between the evolutionary paradigm and the orthodox paradigm of the Christian paradigm.
Yes. Yeah, so it's interesting because you have speciation, which is essentially the transformation of one thing into the next and down the line to where we get human beings. And so this is a really interesting question because you see it even now. People have taken the evolutionary understanding of anthropology and now said, because we have developed rational thought, it is incumbent upon us to bring about the next stage of human-directed evolution. Mm. And so when speaking about transgenderism, it would make perfect sense to then say, okay, well, you know what? I'm just going to direct my own evolution into sort of presenting and becoming as a woman. This is the same philosophy behind transgenderism as the philosophy behind abortion, as the philosophy behind what now is transhumanism. And that's, it's my body. I can do with it what I want. And essentially, I can direct myself and become whatever I want to be. We see this as a fallout from the French existentialist philosophy, with Jean-Paul Sartre saying things like existence precedes essence, which essentially builds on Nietzsche's idea of creating yourself. But when it trickled down into modern understanding, into modern thought, it's you can create yourself whatever you want to be. And so with evolutionary anthropology, that literally means anything, whether it is you want to be a lizard person or a woman if you're a man or half robot.
What about intersex? I mean, is that a good argument? That argument comes up ad nauseum, ad infinitum,
yeah,
you know, that this is a great example of disputing that we're binary, that we're male or female.
So intersex is a fraction of the population. And the thing that's not discussed when we talk about intersex is that there is not a direct correlation between even that tiny, tiny percentage of human beings that are born intersexed and people that suffer from gender dysphoria. So what I'm saying is usually, number one, it's not like someone is born with fully developed female organs and fully developed male organs. There's usually a vestige of one of the sexes and the other one is fully developed. And so when they are discussing what to do with these individuals, instead of a penis, maybe there's like a little nub there. Essentially, you know, they can still tell you are male or female. It just happens that your body grew in such a way that you developed portions or a small beginning of the other sexual organs. But even with that, not every single intersex person is claiming to be transgender. In fact, it's pretty low. The percentage, I don't have it in front of me, but number one, it's a tiny percentage of the population to begin with. It's an outlier. And then of that percentage, it's a tiny percentage that would be seeking sex reassignment.
You know, another thing that I think is helpful in terms of talking about this issue is defining some more terms. There are so many terms that are being bandied about, it almost makes you dizzy. We have cisgender and transgender and non-binary and agender. I mean, there's so many different terms that are being bandied about today. And I think this is part and parcel of what we're talking about earlier, that this is a fast-moving train. I mean, suddenly
yes,
this transgender train is upon us, and we have to learn all these new terms and try to figure it. It's very confusing. Can you give us a little sense of what these terms mean?
Yeah, so cisgender is a term that's used to describe people that are born, let's say I was born biologically male, I identify as a male, I'm married, I have a wife. This is sort of like the typical, you identify with your biological sex and you go about life in a generally pretty gender stereotypically normal way. When we're talking about non-binary or agender, this gets a little bit confusing because essentially what it is someone refusing to identify with what is culturally understood to be a female disposition or a male disposition, whether you like sports or you like pink or you want to wear high heels. It's saying none of that. It's saying that I choose to be my own individual self. I'm non-binary. I reserve the right to like what I like. It has very little to do with the kind of transgenderism that is affected by gender dysphoria. It's essentially a kind of way of reserving your rights as an individual. So it's very strange because all of these things get lumped in together, but they come from different philosophies of thought. So like the non-binary stuff, for instance, comes more from the academic gender theory. I'm a man, but you know what? I like to shop, but I don't identify with other things that are gender stereotypically woman's thing. So I'm just going to be non-binary and I'm just going to pick and choose.
A lot of terminology, and you do a good job in the book of taking each one of these terms, some of them which I mentioned, others that I haven't mentioned, but cisgender and transgender, non-binary, agender, etc., and you define them. Talk about the incredible pressure on the medical establishment and the educational establishment to conform to these new norms.
Yes, so it's difficult because the medical industry and the education industry, if you do not agree with some of this transgender stuff, you will essentially have a mob after you. And it's a mob mentality, really, is what it is. Is if you don't conform to our way, then we will make life so difficult for you, or we will make life so difficult for your hospital or for your university. It's essentially blackmail, is what it is. Because if you didn't have the pressure of getting funding pulled, or having essentially your entire university or hospital at stake because of maybe one person that's an outlier, that's standing out, that actually says something, you know, doesn't just keep quiet to themselves, you can be in big trouble. And so, you know, it's all fine and dandy if you can go along to get along. But what if you're confronted with the issue? You're looking at, as an Orthodox Christian, you're looking at a great potential of losing your job.
You're being forced into linguistic traps. You're being bullied into using preferred pronouns. I mean, it is a train that is creating train wrecks all over the world. And this is not about hate. And I mean, I think we have to really expand upon this. This is about healing. It's not about hate.
Yes.
There are some evangelical groups that are using the motto, gay or straight here, there's no hate here, inferring that if you disagree with this whole agenda that's being foisted on our culture, that you're a hater. But that's not the case at all. I mean, when you look at the shipwrecked lives as a result of this new construct that's being foisted upon humanity at this particular juncture in time, it is necessary to speak out to heal the disfigured bodies as well as disfigured souls, the disfigured body-soul unities.
Yeah, this is something that is difficult because hate is, you know, if you deny my truth, you must hate me because this is what will make me happy. Well, really, most of the time, we don't know what will even make us happy. We're at an advantage in the Orthodox Church because they have laid out for us the path towards salvation. And salvation, again, does not mean something that is disembodied. It means the reality of heaven here. Like, we know what it's like to have hell here. We have it all the time, whether it's in war because of people's greedy choices or hatred that is manifest in these actions. We know and experience this. But human beings, if we want to thrive, have to follow this path. And this is the path towards the cross. This is the path towards theosis. And while we can never force anyone to do anything because of human freedom, we can make entreaties to say, look, I don't hate you. I want what is best for you. And I know, whether it be from experience or from reading about this, that going down this road is a path towards ultimately despair. I saw somewhere, for instance, that the transgender suicide rate is stable across pre-surgery and post-surgery. And so these are the things that are not being spoken about. Of course we care if transgender youth are at risk for suicide. We do not want that. But the reason we would push back is because we're saying going this direction is not decreasing that risk at all.
You bring up orthodoxy a lot, as in the Orthodox Church. Expand on that a little bit, because we're really talking about when the church was young. The teachings of the church fathers, consistent with the teachings of the seven ecumenical councils, the essence of the church when the church was young, passed along from one generation to another generation to another generation. And that's inviolate because it is a proper understanding of what the scriptures have always taught. It's not an independent instance. It's not a complementary source of faith, but it's a proper understanding of the faith once for all delivered to the saints. As St. Paul puts it, as St. Peter puts it, as St. Jude puts it, the fathers and the authors of scriptures have stood in unison on these issues. They've talked about these issues. They thought deeply about these issues. When you read the writings of the fathers on these issues, you think, my goodness, these were sophisticated men, sophisticated theologically, sophisticated medically. These were people who really understood issues. So they're people with gravitas.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And so That's a good clarification, because when I am speaking about the Orthodox Church, I'm speaking about that consensus. And we've had 2,000 years now. I mean, we've practiced confession, communion in the body and blood of our Lord, and working out of these principles of humility, of patience. Think 1 Corinthians 13, just that famous passage on love, working these out and seeing what it does to human lives. And if you want to think about it as a grand experiment, then look at those that are successful in that experiment. Look at the saints. And these are people that did superhuman things, not just in the way of miracles, which they did do, but in the ways of loving those that hated them.
St. Paul talks about the fact that we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers.
Yes.
Spiritual forces of darkness. And you do this in your book. You talk about the spiritual dimension of this battle, the whisperings of demons.
Yes.
And those whisperings are becoming ever louder in our culture. People are being influenced by unseen forces that are as real as the very flesh in our bones. I mean, demons
yes.
are real, angels are real. We don't necessarily see them. And in some sense, they're immaterial. In another sense, compared with God, there's some materiality, I suppose. But these are forces that are wreaking havoc in an ever grander scale in our particular epoch of time.
Yes. So it's common to the patristic literature that the evil one whispers thoughts to us. The demons can whisper thoughts to us. So can the angels, but a lot of the time, you know, we may find ourselves in a situation where a thought comes up and we wonder, where in the world did that come from? And we're told by elders like Elder Thaddeus of Vitovnica that falling into the cycle of having a thought and then worrying so much about why you had that thought and what it means is actually another trap set by the demons. So whether you're a man and you have a lustful thought that pops up, or whether you have a greedy thought or a jealous thought, and you're like, it offends you in a sense. How did this come from me? Well, in some cases it didn't. But now what we have is you have whisperings of the demons that are, if you run a quick Google search, are backed up by a lot of society. And so if someone feels out of place as a biological male and starts to have these thoughts, which are really suffering, producing thoughts, thoughts that produce a great deal of suffering, you now have a cultural acceptance that people have these thoughts, and now they're affirming this way of thinking. And this is extremely dangerous, because when you have an entire culture saying that what the evil one is whispering to us is true, it's hard to get out of that.
Is it fair to say that sex reassignment surgery is out of bounds, period, full stop, no more commentary necessary?
Yes, I think that would be a very fair assessment, not just given what we would believe about bodily mutilation in general, but given the conversation that's already taken place about castration in the church.
How important is it for us to have a handle on this issue? I'm talking about us as people who are giving spiritual guidance to the masses, whether it's through our writings or through our verbal communications on various forums and platforms. How significant is this issue? I mean, we are dealing with so many very transcendently important issues in our culture. How do you rank this?
Oh, it's absolutely vital. It's vital because you have human beings that are suffering, really. Now, let me go back for a second and say the number of transgender individuals suffering with gender dysphoria still is relatively low. For as much hype as there is out there about this, the number is relatively low. But it's important for us to understand dogmatically, as we've already discussed it, about the sexlessness of the soul and there not being a sexual differentiation internally from the outside bodily sex, but then also to move from the dogmatic position to the pastoral. And that pastoral acknowledges that the feelings people are having, the thoughts that they're having, are indeed real and they're causing them a great deal of pain. And by acknowledging and affirming this, regardless of whether or not we believe the content of those feelings is true, let's say a biological man feels like he's a woman, it may not be true. You know, it's not true that he's actually a woman, but those feelings and that discrepancy is a point of suffering for them. And while we may not be able to alleviate that from them, we can work towards a reassignment of their identity from identity as a female trapped in a male body to a child of God.
Yes. So expand on that a little bit. You're saying, in essence, that gender dysphoria is a real thing. You're not denying gender dysphoria. It's real.
Right.
But I want you to expand on that from a different aspect, and that is there's a media narrative that has been foisted upon us. So young kids at an early age are being sort of brainwashed, if I can use that term.
Yeah.
If you take all of the information on one side of a ledger and you suppress it, and you only communicate the information on the other side of a ledger, that by definition is not education, it's brainwashing, really. And so many kids at an early age are subject to this, not only through educational avenues, but also through entertainment avenues. You know, I was taking a walk the other day, I think I mentioned on a podcast, and I see the kids are not looking around, they're not kicking balls at one another, they're looking at their smartphones, and
yes,
they're being indoctrinated in some sense into a particular way of thinking. And so at an early age, kids start to think about, am I really a boy? Am I a girl trapped in a boy's body? All these thoughts that I never even experienced when I was growing up are now commonplace.
Yeah. And there's a wonderful quote from St. Paisius. It's in one of his spiritual councils. He says, essentially, life in the modern world is going to be a lot harder for modern man. And that those that just remain faithful to the end in the modern times will receive a martyr's crown because of how difficult that alone is. And imagine, like you said, it was never even a thought when you were growing up. But now all these young people not only have to contend with the difficulty of adolescence and growing up, but they have to contend with all of these messages that they are getting and how it's said to them, how important it is for them to understand if they're really the right gender or if they're straight or if they're gay or how they think about this thing or the other thing. And growing up's hard enough. I can't imagine if that was part of the question for me, because it wasn't. I just, you know, it wasn't really out there that much.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly important subject, and it is something that the church has dealt with from the very beginning. So just as a summary to our conversation,
yes,
you're saying that the soul is sexless.
Yes.
So we don't have sexed souls.
Yes. The human person itself is definitively sexed on account of the body. And because the human person is the unity of body and soul and not one without the other, we can say that this sex is a given fact.
And again, this is an important distinction to make, right? That the soul is not sex. That has always been the position of historic Christianity.
Yeah, and it wasn't even a question in philosophy until the second century with Apelles the Heretic, who believed in the preexistence of souls, which is essentially why he believed that souls were sexed, because sex was stamped on the body from the soul.
Yeah, and even Apelles the Heretic didn't take this to the logical conclusion that we have in our culture.
Exactly. No, there was no question for him that men were men and women were women. Even though he believed that the soul was sexed, there was no misplacement of a female internal with a male external.
This is sort of an obvious question, but why in the world did you get this interested in wanting to understand the position of the fathers and to delineate the position of the fathers in such a comprehensive fashion so that you could say at the end of your study, the fathers are unanimous in saying that the soul is not sexed?
Sure. So this issue, this question, are souls gendered, actually came up in a seminary classroom in 2017. And I wasn't one to really speak up in class, so I just watched to see what the discussion would look like. And the class was split 50-50, which I was surprised about, because I had happened across some of St. Cyril and St. Theodore the Studite in prior readings, just by happenstance, that said the soul indeed is sexless. So after a little while of this, seeing that the class was confused, I raised my hand, presented my case, and not everyone was convinced. And so I received an email, the entire class received an email from a brother who was fighting for the idea that souls are sexed. And the book itself is kind of my response to the email. So after seeing that email and knowing from St. Cyril and St. Theodore and some of these other fathers that I have just come across the issue in, I started doing research and seeing if there was variation or not. And as it turns out, there isn't. There's one writer in the Christian world that is somewhat ambiguous. And it's because he was trying to refute Apelles, actually. This is Tertullian. And
he's not even a church father in the truest sense of the word.
No, he's not. He fell into heresy. And there's a lot of things about his writings that we don't agree with. There's some good stuff too. So yeah, I would like to make this distinction between a church father and an ancient Christian writer. So this guy was, Tertullian was a Christian. He wrote a lot of literature, but he follows Apelles by methodology and falls into the same error. He was trying to prove that souls come into existence at conception and don't pre-exist the body. But in so doing, he kind of leaves the question of sex. He's like, well, I think it's both, you know, but it was kind of a side note. So this brother used Tertullian to say, you know, I think the souls are sexually differentiated. And then in my research, I went and it's reflected in the book in the Church Fathers section, what all of these different fathers have to say about, you know, is the soul sexually differentiated? And they all say, no, no, it's not.
So you had this situation come up in a classroom environment, and some people believe that the soul was sexed, some people believe that the soul was not sexed. Is this now satisfying the people who believe that the soul was sexed to recognize that the fathers in unison said, no, that's not true, that's never been the official position of the Christian church?
Well, it's a good question. I haven't received word since the publishing of the book from these individuals specifically. I do know that there are some Thomist philosopher theologians that use Aristotle's understanding of the soul being the form of the body to say that souls indeed are sexed. And I've had conversations with these men who were quite curious and interested in my study. At one point, we were going to do a joint article together, but we never got around to it. I think there, these are, of course, Roman Catholic Thomists. There's a little bit of a distinction there as well. At a conference that I presented a paper at, there was some pushback from an Orthodox Christian philosopher who, by his own account, said, you know, my position is not what the Church Fathers say. But I think his understanding was that the Church Fathers, in their rebuttal of Origen, fell into one of Origen's traps. And I just don't see any indication of that in the literature.
So Plato actually believed that the soul was immortal and likely sexless, but Aristotle actually believed the soul isn't necessarily immortal.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. Aristotle has points of divergence from Plato, his great teacher. And one of the things that he's relentlessly criticized for is believing that women are disfigured men, essentially, and that the soul of women is somewhat incomplete. He talks about this from the beginning of conception and the seed being hot or cold, and it's all very strange. But essentially, he believes that the soul of women is lacking something, and that's why they are mutilated men or deformed men.
Well, this was a highly enlightening book for me, particularly this section where you go through what the father said on this particular subject and how significant that is for us to understand today. And so we can have complete confidence in the historic Christian position with respect that this transgender movement is diametrically set in opposition to the historic Christian faith.
Yes.
On Gender and the Soul, an Exploration of Sex, Gender, and Its Relation to the Soul, According to the Church Fathers, Benjamin Cabe. Thank you so much for your contribution to the Hank Unplugged podcast.
Yes, thank you.
Great talking to you today.
You too.
And again, our mission statement is to bring interesting, informative, inspirational people directly to your earbuds, and that on transcendently important subjects. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of the podcast. So long for now.